Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
All right. Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. It's been a few weeks since I've been able to record. I apologize for anyone who's been keeping up with them, with the recordings as I release them. It's just amazing how hard it is to find time when you got three little ones in the house to find some quiet time to be able to record. So here I am on a Saturday morning. Boys are at grandma's and my wife has gone shopping with the baby. So here I am alone. I ought to be mowing the yard, but I'm with you guys here trying to record. So this is lesson number 29 in our series on the book of Acts. And we will be in Acts chapter 23, verses 1 through 35, which will be the whole chapter. And the title of the lesson is Paul and the Jews, Part 2. Now, let's go back just a little bit. Let's set up what's happening. Is Paul has arrived in Jerusalem. It's somewhere around the year 58 AD. And while there, enemies of Paul recognize him, a riot starts, and they are ready to go out and stone Paul. Well, Paul is saved by intervention by the local Roman garrison, and who decides to hold him and get to the bottom of this. And Paul has appealed with his Roman citizenship, which would give him, you know, some benefits, which we explained last week, you know, that prevent them from doing certain punishments to him and gives him a lot more legal right. So he has appealed that. And now what we're going to see is kind of a transition from Paul being judged before the Jews to being judged before the Romans. Now, the Jewish nature and, you know, the Jews are not out of this, but instead of this really being judged by Jewish customs, everything's going to take more of a Roman legal approach. So, we'll just jump right in, I guess. In this lesson, Paul will stand before the high priest. He will use his knowledge of Jewish stances or the, you know, Jewish political nature, I guess, and doctrine to really to get out of there with his life. And then for his own safety, will be transferred to out of Jerusalem to Caesarea. So that's a basic overview. Thank you. Thanks for listening. 3 minutes. No. We're not doing that. We're going to jump right in. We'll take care of everything, okay? The setting will begin in Jerusalem. It's somewhere around the year 58 AD. Now, I have run into a little problem with my dates that I've been using. I've been relying on a website that has a very nice outline of Paul's missionary journey, and I've been relying on their dates. Well, doing a little research for this one, I ran into a case where their dates don't seem to match the more commonly accepted dates, specifically the dates that I have found on sites like Wikipedia. And the problem with dates is, honestly, if you study this out, and I think I've spoken about this a little bit, I'm not sure, but if you study this out, it really comes down to a best guess, and there's really no even specific dates. It is a mess when you go trying to convert the different calendars. The Jewish calendar was a lunar calendar, as were many of the calendars at the time. And so basically their months followed the phases of the moon, which of course leads to a problem, the 365-day solar year. So they would actually have a leap month. And, you know, very strange things. The Roman calendar, I don't remember how many days it had off the top of my head, but they actually had an 8-day week. So it's crazy when you, and then you try to convert that to the calendar we use now, which has only been in use, what is it, about 250 years? Bet you didn't know that, but you can look that up. It actually transitioned while America was in the colonies Britain switched to the new Gregorian calendar. I believe it's Gregorian. But anyway, you want some interesting, mind-boggling reading? Look that stuff up, and you'll realize how crazy it is for anyone to try to set dates, especially stuff that's hundreds and thousands of years old. It's just nigh impossible to set dates and correlate them to the modern calendar. All right, so, but anyway, it's 50 AD, and I'll point out later when we get to Felix that my sources that I was looking at say he was the Roman ruler over Judea from 52 to 58 AD, and it kind of does not work if this is 58 AD and he ended his rule in 58 AD. So, just give me some leniency here. I'm trying to be consistent with my dates, but my different sources are conflicting. Now, the first part of this will actually, as Paul stands before the Jewish rulers, which actually we've actually set up in the previous chapter, takes place in what's called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. This room is in the temple complex. There's some debate about exactly where it was. But this is where the traditional meeting place of the Sanhedrin. So, it was something I'm not very familiar with. You can do some looking up on. There's not a lot of information on it, but this particular room was actually part of the temple complex that was built by Herod. And according to my dates, I want to point out that this is somewhere a little bit less than 25 years after Paul's conversion. So, to give you an idea of how long he's, been away from being, one of the Jewish leaders, it's been about 25 years. So, when my mind thinks that, perhaps he probably knew who the high priest was, maybe had some dealings with him before. But looking out over the Sanhedrin, there were a number of guys in that group that he probably knew on a personal basis he was a member of the Sanhedrin too, by most accounts. And, perhaps these were his former friends. I mean, definitely his colleagues. So you would think that many of them, because the Sanhedrin would have a lot of the older members, these were not young guys. So in 25 years, there probably has been a pretty good turnover, but not completely. So just adds a little something else to the story. So let's just jump right on in, and we'll get through this. Not a lot of action and excitement, but nonetheless, very important to see. And this whole stretch really it gets into the legal stances and the different trials and what they're trying to do. Basically, right now the Romans are allowing the Jews to try. To try Paul according to their customs, as a Jew. Now, the Roman protection is going to kick in a little bit later, but right now, that's just what the garrison leader, felt what was best. It's just, let's see what's going on. I think right now he's still kind of investigating, what's going on. Well, we saved him from riot. Let's put him before the Sanhedrin. Probably he doesn't realize that, they have some dealings with Paul, a couple of decades old, but, nonetheless, maybe he doesn't realize there's a familiarity there. So, that's basically what's happening right now, is Paul is going to be tried as a Jew, and then we're going to see it really become more of a Roman affair at the end of this chapter. So, let's jump in, Acts 23, verse 1. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, and this council is, as I said, the Sanhedrin. I don't know if I've discussed them. I think I have. It's a group of about 70 men that, actually, I think it's 71 counting the high priestess. I think that's right. And supposedly their basis goes all the way back to Moses, and setting up, this the rulers and people that helped him take care of the people. There's no evidence for that. It appears to be something that really came back after, like, the Babylonian captivity, something that sprang up, and maybe even later than that. There's not a lot of historical basis for it, but it was what they did at the time, and these rulers, you know, were the, kind of the ultimate court and legislature for the people. And so Paul is standing before them and will be tried. And here he's going to begin to give his defense. So our earnestly beholding the council said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." So I really think he's beginning. He's this isn't just one statement. He's really about to get in. He's hoping to get their attention by claiming that, you know, hey, he's right, that what he's doing is just following God's leading, just as those men out there believe that they have. But nonetheless, the high priest is going to shut them up, verse 2. "And the high priest Ananias commanded that them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth." Did I cover Ananias? I think I did in Luke. I should have done some more research on him. There's some interesting stuff if you want to do that. Well, I apologize. I dropped the ball on that one. I should have researched that a little bit out. "Commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth," which actually, this is, I'm trying to remember on this, something that, you know, for disrespecting punishment, but even still, this is really something they weren't supposed to do. This is really kind of out of character in that request. So one of the guards that's staying by him, you know, slaps him in the face, probably, you know, a backhanded, you know, deal, slaps him in the face. And verse 3, "Then said Paul unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" So it's like, you know, so Paul's really getting testy at that point. it reminds you of, you know, of Jesus' sermons against the Pharisees, you know, talking about whited sepulchers, and that's basically what he's saying is, look, you know, you're judging me and you're breaking the law here. Verse 4, "And they that stood by him, revilest thou God's high priest?" This is kind of an interesting little thing here. It's kind of out of character for Paul to even say something like that. And the people sitting by are like, "What are you doing? Are you attacking God's high priest?" Well, Paul, still being a Jew and probably knowing the crowd to a certain extent, realizes, you know, you can't get by with that. So verse 5, "Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people." And that quote is from Exodus 22:28, if you want to look that up. But basically Paul's saying, look, I didn't realize. And most Bible scholars, you know, think, you know, he did not realize who said that Paul was just lashing out after being struck, and would not have done that out of respect for the office of the high priest had he realized who it was. So, which is strange because the high priest normally dressed differently and stuff. So, you know, a little bit of debate there you can go into. It's really not that important. Now, the next thing is kind of interesting. We'll get into a little bit of the history here. Paul's going to divide the crowd here. Probably realizing at this point, because the high priest is breaking rules himself, this is not going to be a fair trial. Paul is going to turn the fighting from against him to in between each other in the Sanhedrin. Verse 6, "But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead, am I called in question." All right, we'll get into this. Let's go ahead and we'll read down. Let's see here. Let's read a couple more verses, and then we'll deal with this. Verse 7, "And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both." Just a little bit of an explanation there in verse 8 given by Luke as he wrote this. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, some of the differences. it's really not very well understood in a lot of cases. It's something I've even had a hard time kind of grasping. The Pharisees are the more well-known of the bunch. You know, we don't go around calling people Sadducees nowadays, but you will hear people call Pharisees. But the Pharisees really began kind of coming out of the Babylonian captivity as a movement. It's where they kind of trace their lineage to. And these guys were Jews. There's two main things that they believe. Number one, they accepted all, oral law and tradition on top of the scriptures. So they accepted the teachings of the rabbis, and really that is the basis for the modern Judaism. Goes back to the Pharisees, their view eventually won out. But at this time, there's a pretty heated debates over this stuff. But basically, if Rabbi, Rabbi Eleazar said 200 years before that when on the Day of Atonement that, you should only put your left hand on the head of the goat instead of the right hand, well, they debated whether that, they accepted that. The scripture may not be, clear on that, and that's just an example. I may be completely off on that, but it's funny when you get into it, though, all that oral law stuff and the tradition, if you get into studying that, it's full of contradictions. Rabbi so-and-so says do it this way. Rabbi so-and-so says do it this way. And there's just a list of these things of, 10 different opinions of rabbis on how things ought to be done differently. But the Pharisees, basically, they found a way to carry out the Mosaic law and all the traditions, the Jewish identity, to the infinite degree, to the point like Christ spoke of, to tithing on spices, taking a razor blade and separating out a tenth of spices and stuff like that. The second important thing is that they believed in the afterlife and the immortality of the soul. So they believed in the sense of a heaven and hell like we would. And this differs from the Sadducees. You think, wow, well, didn't everybody? Well, no, the Sadducees didn't. Well, let's get to them. The Sadducees, they're a little bit harder to trace. Not as much is known about them as, say, because the Pharisees kind of won out after the Jewish revolt and such. But the Sadducees actually were at times the more powerful party. We hear so much more of the Pharisees, but I've read that the Sadducees actually were the more political, more politically influential than the Pharisees at the time. Number one, in comparison to the Pharisees, they accepted only the written law. So basically, that they took a very strict interpretation of the scriptures, very strict, literal. If it's there, we believe it. If it's not, we don't believe it, which is very admirable in a sense. But with that, point number two is that they denied the afterlife because it just was not clearly stated. They couldn't turn over to Exodus and Moses wrote that, hey guys, after we die, we go to heaven, and this happens because it was not clearly spelled out in the Old Testament. They didn't believe it. And they didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in spirits. They basically believed they didn't believe in the resurrection. They basically believed that life, was just the here and now. And very strange, you think, for a religious group to believe that. But they went back to a very strict, literal interpretation of the Old Testament, and they just didn't see the afterlife there. And these two groups, the Pharisees and Sadducees, were always fighting, doctrinal discussions and such. And these kind of were the main, especially the afterlife thing, that was the main point of disagreement between them. So now I hope that explains. And there's a lot more to this. If you want to do some research, there is a lot more to what these groups believed in their history. That's just a very brief overview. Some people even claim that the Sadducees were like Greek influenced and really took more of a philosophical look at Judaism. And I can't see a lot of, I've heard that before, but I haven't seen a lot of evidence for that as I was studying this out. But as I say, there's a lot of stuff. You can go in there and you can bore yourself with a lot of technical reading if you want to on these two groups. So let's go back to verse 9 now. We'll pick up where we left off. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." So the Pharisees are going to support him. Because, hey, he was a Pharisee? The resurrection? Well, hey, we're going to be behind him. And verse 10, and when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and to take him by force from among them and bring him into the castle. So, as you know, the Pharisees are now defending Paul, and the Sadducees are now fighting. It turns into infighting there in the Sanhedrin, and the Romans are now are afraid for Paul's safety. And being a Roman citizen, they are obligated to protect him. They go down and rescue him from this riot that's beginning to happen there among the Jewish rulers. It just goes to show you, politics, it never changes, does it? So anyway, they rescue him and take him back into the Fortress Antonia to save him. Now, verse 11, it's kind of just thrown in here, but it really is kind of important to realize all this stuff is not happening by accident. This really, I believe, is part of God's plan for Paul. Now, Paul's going to suffer here for a few years. He's going to be a prisoner. He's really kind of going to be in limbo, in a sense, because there's not sure what's going to happen to him. It's going to be a while before he heads to Rome, and there's going to be standing before a few different rulers and a few different trials, and it's going to take a while for things to work. And you think, well, shouldn't he be out, sailing to Italy or Spain or Africa, or go back to Greece or Asia Minor? Shouldn't he be going out and preaching the word, starting churches? God had a different plan for him, and this was it, that he should be a prisoner and give witness before the Roman rulers and eventually find his way to Rome. And verse 11 is some evidence of that. And beginning verse 11, and the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." So God just, in his grace, just reveals a little bit of his plan and his will for Paul, just saying, look, Paul, it's okay. Because Paul, probably his faith is shaking. What am I going to do? He's scared. This is not at all what he envisioned going back to Jerusalem. I think he was all ready to be stoned and be a martyr. I think, that was something that he did not fear. But, this whole thing of being in bonds and I don't think that was necessarily what he realized. And I really think he was probably struggling and just God in his grace looked down and said, "Paul, don't worry about it. Listen, everything's still under control. This is all part of the plan." Isn't it good when God does that? Unfortunately, it doesn't happen sometimes in the midst of a storm. Sometimes it does. You get a sense of peace. But sometimes afterwards, you get that little light bulb moment where something clicks and it's like, oh, that's why that happened. we have to have faith in God. God's in control. And listen, I do believe everything happens for a purpose in the life of a Christian. And we can use our experiences to help others, and perhaps we go through things to strengthen us. But isn't it good just to know and just to realize that God's in control and he hasn't forsaken us and he hasn't left us. And, we're his child. We're always going to be under his care and under his love. All right, so verse number 12, we're going to reveal that the Jews are still not very happy with Paul. They're going to try to kill him. Verse 12, and when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. So evidently they starved to death, or they didn't keep their keep their vow. Verse 13, and they had made more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. So evidently a few days from now, 40 people starved to death. Verse 14, and they came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse that that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. So I'm sure everybody's like, yay, woohoo, these guys are so great. They're such great patriots. And unfortunately, it's not going to work. Verse 15, now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him, and we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him. So, like, the chief priest is going to be in on the conspiracy. They're going to kill this guy. I mean, this is big time. This really pops in my mind, the assassination of Julius Caesar. I mean, this is like some kind of big plot here going on. And you know, like most plots, word gets out. Verse 16. And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. So Paul's nephew hears of this and goes to warn Paul, which is interesting. You know, you don't hear a lot about Paul's family. And evidently this guy must have been a Christian, because as a Jew, if this guy actually was, you know, a member of the Sanhedrin or had some dealings with it, I mean, he's probably not going to be inclined to help Paul. So it's kind of interesting. I wish we knew a little bit more about this fellow. Verse 17. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him. Verse 18. So he took him. I cannot read this one. And brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called. I like that. Paul the prisoner. It's, you know, his new title. He's been Paul the apostle. Now he's Paul the prisoner. Called me unto him, and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who hath something to say unto thee. So verse 19, then the chief captain took him by the hand, and went with him aside privately, and asked him, what is this thou hast to tell me? Verse 20, and he said, the Jews have agreed to desire thee, that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. 21, but do not thou yield unto them, for they lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee. So the plan's revealed, and the good thing, I'll tell you, one of the heroes in this story is this Roman captain. And you know what? I forgot. I was going to look up and see what his rank was, and I forgot to do that. But, I mean, this guy really is a hero. I mean, a lot of this, he's following procedure, and this isn't maybe so much that he's a great moral guy, but, I mean, he really is doing his best to do his duty and to save Paul. Verse 22. So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, see thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me. Verse 23, and he called unto him two centurions, saying, make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night. So this really is like the middle of the night here. He's like, get a small army here ready. I'm not sure how big the garrison was, but this is a pretty sizable detachment. I mean, this not just taking a little squad out or, you know, sending a couple of guards with them. I mean, this is like a pretty good-sized group here. Verse 24, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor. So he's going to get him out of town and make sure that he is safe and take him to Felix. verse 25, and he wrote a letter after this manner. Claudius Lysias, actually the guy's name, you know, the captain, that's kind of neat that you actually get his name. Unto the most excellent governor, Felix, sendeth greeting. Okay, so let's deal with that. Let's deal right quick with who is Felix. Felix, his full name is Marcus Antonius Felix. We know a little bit about him from the writings of Josephus and such. This is my date conflict I spoke of earlier. He was the Roman procurator. That's the technical title there, of the province of Judea, from 52 to 58 AD. So, you know, it works with my scale, but the 58 AD, I really would feel better if that said 60 or something. So, but anyway, that's what we've got to deal with. But that type of time frame is when he was the Roman ruler. And he does have a connection to a more famous person. That is, he's the younger brother of Marcus Antonius Pallas, P-A-L-L-A-S, and you can look him up. He was a freedman who was treasurer, very, very powerful individual in Rome, and very, 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 I'm going blank. Don't you love it when you get a word in your mind and you can't think? He was kind of a lightning rod type figure. Let's use that. I cannot think of the right word I'm thinking of. So anyway, that's who this guy is. So he probably was a freedman, was not a was not a Roman citizen by birth. Now Roman citizen. This is kind of that strange little time period. I believe Nero was the governor, or Nero was the emperor at the time, if I'm remembering right. And there's a lot of these freedmen that are getting positions of power, and it really is very, very controversial among the Roman elite and the Roman establishment, you know, because, like, well, these guys weren't, you know, they don't trace their ancestors back to the Republic and, you know, back to the days of old, and, you know, so it's very much it's very controversial stuff. But a lot of these guys were able to become bureaucrats in the Roman system and attain some wealth and attain some power, and to the point that at times basically some of these guys were running the empire. The emperor may have been the technical head, but it really came down to guys like this. Under Claudius, even was it the Praetorian leader, as it said, Sejanus? I'm going blank on his name, but I mean, basically, he was running the empire while Claudius was out on the Isle of Capri doing his perverted stuff. So, anyway, that was what Pallas was, and so Felix, being his younger brother, you know, similar deal. I mean, it's pretty important. I mean, there's not just a whole lot of these, you know, provincial appointments and, and it could be very, very lucrative. This was something that people really strive for to get these type of appointments. So that's Marcus Antonius Felix, who's known as Felix, which Felix, think happy Felicitas in the Latin, what his name was. I don't know if I've spoken about Roman names. Roman names are interesting. There's always three. They have their first name, and there's technical terms for all this, and I can't remember off the top of my head. But the first name, there's only a handful. There's usually Marcus and Gaius, and, you know, they're almost always something along those lines. The second name is the family name, and Antonius. So probably related to Mark Antony, Marcus Antonius. Or at least in that family line, it was much broader than just Mark Antony. But then the last name that you have there, the Felix, is kind of like their nickname. That's usually what people would call them by in a lot of cases. It's really what would set them apart from their ancestors. So it's very, very confusing. For instance, like Julius Caesar, his full name was Gaius Julius Caesar. Gaius being kind of his first name is a family name. Julius was his particular clan, his particular, you know, family tribe. And then Caesar was, you know, just kind of the little added name. And to make things more difficult, there was actually more than one Gaius Julius Caesar. So, but it's pretty obvious which one was which. There's some cases where it's not, but in his case, it was very easy to tell, you know, who was Caesar and who wasn't. So anyway, but that's just something added for your benefit. So let's read this letter that's given here. So 4 or 5 verses long. We'll verse 26. We'll go ahead and reread it. Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix, sendeth greeting. Verse 27. This man was taken of the Jews, and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. Verse 28. And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth into their council. Verse 29, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. Verse 30, and when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee, and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. So basically he's laying out what happened. Hey, look, I rescued Paul. I didn't know what was going on. I let him go before the council, found out that didn't work. And so I still don't know what's going on, but hey, these guys are mad enough to kill him. And listen, I don't know what to do. So guess what? You're governor. You get to deal with it. He's just kind of passing the buck, you know, escalating the issue up the chain of command. And which probably, you know, he was commanded to do. I mean, listen, being in Jerusalem in a feast time as this was, there's crowds of people. I mean, you're sitting on a keg of dynamite in situations like this. If a riot broke out, I mean, they probably could or probably would try to overrun and throw out the Romans. You did not want something like this happening out, especially at this time of the year. So, you know, he gets them out of town, gets it away from Jerusalem. Very smart move by him, you know, strategically speaking, to get Paul out of there, you know, get the detonator away from the dynamite and gets it all away. And that way, if there's a problem, it can happen in Caesarea, but not in Jerusalem, because Caesarea was more of a Gentile town. There's very, wasn't as much, I'm not going to say, I was almost said very small, but it was not a, a Jewish town. It was very much a Greek style town, and this is the Roman city government. We'll deal with that in a little bit. So anyway, gets him out of town, just says, look, this is what's going on, and I'm sending him to you, and I'm telling, you know, we're going to tell them to argue the case before you, because I don't know what's going on. You know, really, it's probably beyond his authority. Verse 31, then soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Now, Antipatris is a small town. It's kind of the halfway point on the road between Jerusalem and Caesarea. Not really important historically to this point, if I remember right. I think afterwards it has some in the Jewish revolt. Verse 32, and on the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him. So basically, like this, he sends an army with him to at least get them out of range of Jerusalem. And then from this point, he's just going to send the cavalry with them. So the horsemen to go with him and return to the castle. So verse 33, who when they came to Jerusalem and delivered the epistle, that's a letter, you know, they're not delivering a book of the Bible, epistle just kind of means a letter, to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, and Cilicia is the Roman province, Southeast Asia Minor, that's where Tarsus is. Verse 35, I will hear thee, said he, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. So there we go. Really, it's amazing. I feel like we keep dropping off, and the chapter divisions may not be the best. You know, before, you know, in this chapter, it seems like every time we're leading into the next chapter, this is a whirlwind series of events that's taking place right here. And, you know, here we go. It's like, okay, well, Paul's there, and, you know, pretty soon we're going to have to wait for the high priest and everybody to come up there and accuse him. So, let me go back. I'll talk to you a little bit. Caesarea, sometimes called Caesarea Maritima, looks like maritime, replaced the last A with an E. This is the Roman capital of Judea. It was built by Herod the Great. And I say this basically was a new town that was built along the Greek style. It's a very Greek Gentile type town. There's temples there. There's, you know, amphitheater. There's a palace there. This was the Romans was the seat of power. It's also a has a harbor, which is one of the very few on the coast, and it mostly because it's man-made, because the Romans were very good at building those. They actually had a type of cement that could set underwater. It's very interesting. So, but anyway, that's where the Roman city government is, and most of the time, the Roman leaders actually stayed there. They were not in Jerusalem. They stayed away from there. They didn't like it. It was a step down. And unless there was a particular business to be done or at certain times of the year for a show of power during feasts and such, they would go down to Jerusalem. But for the most part, they stayed up in Caesarea. So it says Herod's Judgment Hall. Herod built most of the town, so a lot of stuff was called, you know, Herod's this, Herod's that. But this particular Judgment Hall was kind of like the seat of the government power, where they would hear cases and, you know, where the business would be done. Let's see here. I think that's about it for now. I'm looking at my notes, and I've already talked about Antipatris and Cilicia, so we're just going to have to wait till next time to get into chapter 24 when Paul's accusers arrive, and Paul gets to hear his case, gets his case heard before Felix. And we'll just have to deal with that next time. I appreciate you listening today. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. Check out BaptistBasics.org for more resources. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today.